Well, good evening and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. That cut opening tonight's show was Time Stood Still by Alaya Deo. And happy Women's History Month. As we know, history was written by the conquerors, the ones with the time and money to write, the ones with an agenda to shape patriarchal society. And there's a real dearth, an absence, a shortage of accolades for women and by women. Not because women were not making history, but because they were too busy to write it all down or because their work was marginalized. There was a reason some women wrote under a male name. Using a male name automatically carried more weight, gave you more credibility. And what a terrible shame. Every year when Women's History Month rolls around, we have to remember this. So many women went unnoticed, but we're trying to fix that. Well, do you know what might be going on in your town to celebrate Women's History Month? If you're planning something to celebrate, please email me or send me a note in the chat room, which will be open shortly. And if you'd like to call in, the number is 718-766-4662. I know most of you do listen from the archives, but if you're listening live tonight, we invite you to chat with myself or my guests. And tonight, first up, I have with us Sister Greta Roningen, or Roningen, from the Community of Divine Love, discussing Living Love, the spirituality of the Beguines, a 13th century women's movement. We'll learn how they risked their lives to speak and write their experiences and how the Beguines can inspire us today. Sister Greta is a chaplain working with adult men and women and young girls incarcerated in Los Angeles County jails, and she leads retreats inspired by her thesis, Becoming Beguines, Living Love, both mystically and, help me, Sister Greta.
Apostolically.
Thank you. I cannot say that word. as we cross the threshold then into the second half of the show, Gus DiZarega is back discussing his new book, Fault Lines, The Culture War and the Return of the Divine Feminine, an in-depth study of the crisis in American society and the government from a pagan perspective. Gus's first book was on democratic political theory and practice, his second, Pagans and Christians, the personal spiritual experience, and his third book, The Burning Times, a pagan and Christian in dialogue. Interesting stuff. Gus is back with us for the second time tonight. Then later tonight, after my guests, please stay tuned for my What's the Buzz segment, talking about those bees buzzing around in my bonnet, related to the sacred feminine ideals, either being supported or thwarted in the world today. We have some interesting stuff out of India and actually some words from another sister, Christine Schenck, who has a great article on the blog Simply Spirit, and the title is Religion the Biggest Problem Facing Feminism Today? And we have A Day in the Life of Joe Republican, too. So lots of stuff I think you're going to be interested in, in the latter part of the show. But first, a word from Joe Carson and Dancing with Gaia, which, as you know, if you're a regular to the show, helps me pay to keep Voices of the Sacred Feminine on the air. That said, if you like what you're hearing and you want to ensure the show keeps on the airwaves here at Blog Talk, please go to my website, KarenTate.com. Once you're there, go to my Goddess Store page, scroll down to the PayPal buttons, and make a donation of any amount. And thank you for your donations and your kind emails that let me know what I'm doing here is making a difference in your life. So, a word from Joe Carson.
Most people's psychic experiences are dreaming, and it's thought that it's the pineal gland making this chemical that does it. Now, this was the core finding that the pineal gland makes a hallucinogen. We all hallucinate, we all go into a state of consciousness that for me is the collective unconscious. This psychic state is the collective unconscious, which is that consciousness of the planet, what's called the chthonic mind, the mind of the earth. Because all peoples, all races, all tribes from the past and right around the world have myths and legends which use symbols and archetypes which are identical. Every human being experiences this state of consciousness, which is the dream mind, that symbolic, archetypal, exemplified by fairy tales, or the creation myths and legends of all the different peoples. The symbols of them are the same, and to me that is the consciousness of the earth speaking to us.
Well, that was Serena Roney Dougal, PhD, speaking in Joe Clarkson's film Dancing with Gaia. Dancing with Gaia explores the connections between earth energy, sacred sexuality, and the goddess as Gaia. It features 15 visionaries, just like Serena, who give us tools to feel the life of the planet within ourselves. And the DVD comes with a 45-page book and costs only $20. You can get it for your library at dancingwithgaia.com. Well, you have been tuning in for the last couple months, you know I've been sharing news about my new book, Goddess Calling, and in the conversation sometimes my other books come up. So I just wanted to share a review that came in this week on Facebook by Susan from Australia. She says, "Hi, Karen, love your podcasts and all your interviews. I'm buying your books right now and look forward to enjoying them. Thank you for all the work you put into the podcasts. I love them, and I tell all my friends here in Australia to tune in. I am learning so much." Thank you, Susan. I appreciate that. You are gas in my tank. So, that said, let's not let Sister Greta wait any longer. Let's get to her, and we'll start off by introducing her to you, my dear listeners. Sister Greta Roningen is a professor, professed member of the Community of Divine Love, an Episcopal monastery in the Benedictine tradition located in San Gabriel, California. Greta is a chaplain working with both adult men and women and young girls incarcerated in Los Angeles County jails. She's been involved with yoga for 35 years and co-created Yoga Works in 1986. She holds a master's degree from Claremont School of Theology and Spiritual Formation. And as I said earlier, she lectures and she leads retreats inspired by her master thesis, Becoming Begins. So, hi, Greta. Thank you for being on the show tonight.
Oh, thank you so much, Karen. It's an honor. Appreciate it.
Well, and you know, it's so nice to have somebody local, too.
Yes.
Yeah, you're not that far away at all, and a number of my friends have actually been graduates over there of Claremont School of Theology, so I feel like it's a small world. So Greta, why don't we start with you telling us who the Beguines were, because, and it's spelled B-E-G-U-I-N-E-S. Is that French?
Yes. It's Middle East, you know, it's going back to a Flemish, what's called the Low Countries in the 13th century. So it's not really any language. Therefore, the pronunciation is varied too. Some say Beguines, some say Beguines, but just for simplicity, I say Beguines. But that's where it started. It was birthed in the Low Countries.
Greta, we're having a little bit of a connection problem. You're kind of breaking up. Is your connection good there, or maybe it's your headset or something? I'm just wondering if there's any adjustment you can make.
Let me see if I'm. Is it better now? I'm moving a little bit to another place. Okay.
Yes, it actually is much better.
Okay.
So I hate to ask you to repeat that, but I really don't think it was understandable.
Okay.
So would you mind telling us again?
Sure.
Who were the Beguines, and is that French?
The Beguines began in the 13th century, and they were in an area called the Low Country, which is now Holland, Belgium, southern Germany, and northern France. So it was languages that really aren't current. No one really knows what the history of the word, the Beguines, are, because it was They still don't. None of the scholars of the Beguines really know where that word came from. But it's quite unique unto itself. And what's amazing, Karen, is that this is a movement that went on for 800 years, and over a million women were involved in the Beguine movement, and almost no one has heard of them.
That sort of goes back to what I said opening the show about Women's History Month. You know, we have lost so much of what women contributed to society because it either was, you know, either simply not written down or, will you tell me, in the case of the Beguines, why do we not know about them?
Well, I'm really not sure. It's obviously, like you said, that the history was written by the males, but their books are becoming more. Their books exist and have been published in English in the last like 50 years. So I'm hoping, I'm sort of the Beguine evangelist, that there will be a growing interest because they're so brilliant, and they risked really their lives to tell their stories and their experiences, these mystical experiences that they were having of God. And one of them actually was burned at the stake in 1310 in France, in northern France, for heresy. But these women that were writing their stories are the first published women in the vernacular, well, of any type, in those languages. So it's very, very unique and important, their writings.
So would they be on par, I don't mean time-wise, because I forget the dates that she lived, but would they sort of be Christian mystics like Hildegard von Bingen or Julian of Norwich?
Yes, they're in between. So Hildegard was 12th century, and Julian is 14th century. What happened in the 13th century was there was a large movement in Europe of a hunger for spiritual renewal, and this is known as the same time as Saint Francis. The Beguines were happening actually a little before Francis. These were women of privilege and probably of nobility, many of them, who left their lives, escaped enforced marriage or arranged marriages, which were all had to do with property rights and so on, to live in communities that they created themselves. It was outside of any hierarchical, any church authority. So it was communities by women and for women, and they were dedicated.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but so unlike Hildegard, who I think she still sort of had to answer to the bishops and things, these women were sort of independent out there on their own, not under the thumb of the church.
Absolutely. They absolutely were. They were self-supporting. So if they didn't have resources, which some did, because women were allowed to have property at that time, but if they didn't have resources, they shared with the others, or they've got simple jobs, like in the textile industry, which was growing then. But they were dedicated to working in leper sanitariums, which were the most marginalized people, and it was almost of epidemic proportions, and the poor, because this was a time when the urban poor was a growing concern, and these women stepped out of the society roles and really dedicated themselves to both this mystical seeking of this, which I'll talk about later, this profound divine union with God, but also in charitable acts of working with not only the poor but the lepers.
So, all right, let me just make sure I have this right. So So you said that they left their families and oftentimes to avoid, you know, some arranged marriage. They didn't probably want to be chattel themselves. So these women maybe were more educated. Did they come from more, well-to-do families?
Absolutely.
At
the beginning, in the 13th century, it was the educated and the noble class of women. And some of them, Karen, even their stories would have, their families might have orchestrated a rape by a man to entrap them into a marriage. So it was a very, that's why they think that one of the most famous writers, Hedwig, has no history whatsoever, because it would have been to keep her safe from possibly her own family. But yes, the first movement of women that were living together in these fairly small groups in a house, let's say 7 to 15 women, they would have been from the noble and the educated class. Later, because this did go until just recently, the last Beguine just died. It was actually at the very back of the Economist magazine, as reported, it's the last Beguine just died, who had been in Belgium. But in the 13th century, they did move into a more organized living, and they had huge beguinages in like Brussels and Bruges, and those housed up to 1,500 women. And so then at that time, they were taking in women who from all classes, and certainly the poor, and women who even had children.
So this was not anything like when the church had the nuns, you know, like we have hear those horror stories of the nuns in Ireland who so terribly abused some of the women they took in. This was nothing like that at all. This was totally different, type of arrangement.
Absolutely. These were women by women, for women, and they were really committed to acts of charity and outside. It wasn't cloistered. So they were very much in the world, helping to be forces of healing and committed to what's called the apostolic life. And that means living the life of the apostles, living with shared in community with shared resources, but emulating the life of Christ.
So how did they support themselves? I mean, did they have wealthy benefactors, or were they working outside as well as doing their charitable work?
No, they were completely self-supporting, which is quite unique. They, as I said, some of them had resources that they brought into the living environment and they shared. But those who didn't, they didn't take money. They purposely wouldn't take money from the church or from benefactors. They earned their own living. They felt that was the apostolic life. So they kept simple jobs, some as teachers, some in, as I said, in the textile industry, which was very big then, and then working when they could for the poor and the sick.
Well, I know you said later on they maybe took in women who even had children. Were they, were they celibate?
Absolutely celibate. That was the only commitment. They didn't have a rule the way that traditionally monastics live under a rule of life, like Benedict's or Augustinian rule. These women had very little hierarchy. They were quite democratic. They did later have to have more sort of issue control, but the only commitment they had to make was that while they lived in community, they were celibate, and they were free to leave whenever they chose.
Okay. This is really interesting, and the fact that the last one just died, so
yeah.
This has been going on for hundreds of years. I'm amazed.
800 years. I know. It's incredible.
So at the heyday, I mean, how many did they have around the world, and were they more or less restricted to that, you know, that part of the world you've described, that, Belgium, up in there?
Yes. it very much was specific to that area. And I, in the 1500s was where there were the most active and these very, very large communities. They were called Beguinages, and they were scattered all over that low country area. And they, as I said, some of them had 1,500 women. So they were like cities. They had their own chapel. They had a hospital. They had they would have burial grounds. They had large areas, you know, of living in community. And there's still some of these have survived and are essentially museums in Bruges and in Brussels. But
wow.
They were scattered, the Beguinages were scattered throughout those areas, and it was 3 to 5% of the population were Beguines.
So did they experience hostility from the outside world? I mean, after all, these uppity women on their own with, you know, not under the thumb of a man or the church.
At the beginning they were revered. They were considered holy women. And even there's a story that in one of the books that St. Francis was trying to travel to come to meet one of the women who are considered to be the first Beguines, but she died before he got there. They were revered, they were protected, they were encouraged to exhort one another. Later, when they started to publish, this one Beguine, her name is Marguerite Poré, and she was French. She wrote a book called The Mirror of Simple Souls, and in it she's quite overtly critical of the church and of the hypocrisy and of the corruption. She calls the church reason, and in a fairly openly veiled way of attacking them. But it's a beautiful book, and it talks about the journey of the soul to union, to beyond the God, to what she calls the Godhead. And on that journey, one leaves behind even acts of virtue, because the virtuous acts could develop in one a sense of pride, which would be in the way of this journey of the ego into nothingness, into the Godhead. So she was called out as that was considered not orthodox thinking, that you would leave behind the virtues, and she was she was forced to burn her own books.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was told that she could never publish again, and she didn't follow that. She did publish again. She rewrote her book. She did distribute it. She was put in prison, and she was given, over a course of a year, her inquisitor, who was a Dominican man, he begged her to recant her position and say she was wrong and therefore save her life, and she wouldn't. And finally, after a year, she was taken to be burned, and the story goes that those who witnessed her, what I called in a paper I wrote, her final annihilation, because she talks, Karen, about the journey to the Godhead of being an annihilation of the created will to become one with the will of God. So this was her final annihilation, was her acceptance of this death at this gruesome, you know, burning at the stake. But
so it was like the ultimate surrender.
Exactly.
You know, so like, yeah.
And that people who experienced her execution in this gruesome way were actually transformed and had conversion experiences because they were so amazed by the peace and the beauty with which she met that fate. But after her death, this is what's interesting. I mean, of all of it's amazing, but her inquisitor lived with Meister Eckhart, who is a highly revered a mystical author of Christian mysticism, and he writes about this journey to the Godhead. He uses language that the Beguines use. And so now, only now, the feminist Christian theologians are now acknowledging and recognizing that Meister Eckhart, who has volumes written about him, was influenced by the Beguine authors.
Isn't that interesting? You know, I know this is a little bit off subject, but, you know, I took Kabbalah classes for about a year and a half because I found their beliefs that, you know, we should care and share and, you know, different things were sort of in sync with, you know, things that I believed in. And, you know, you always heard about the old rabbis, you know, the oldest of the old rabbis that influenced the work. And it was so funny because it felt like to me every time I heard that, it seemed to me, and, you know, maybe it's just me because of, you know, my bias, but it felt like the stuff they were teaching and the stuff that they believed was very similar to what we think might have been the teachings in either, you know, matrilineal or matrifocal or egalitarian societies, you know, more about the instead of the I and the me, the we and the us. And I couldn't help but think every time I heard these rabbis getting credit for, you know, these ideals, that who did they get it from?
Yeah.
You know, but anyway, that's neither here nor there. But, now this is probably a crazy question, but just having heard her story, please say her name again.
Marguerite Poiret, P-O-R-E-T-E, Poiret.
Having heard her story and the things that were, were attributed to people who witnessed her burning, I guess it's crazy to think that anybody's thinking of making her a saint.
Oh, yeah, no. None of the Beguines. There were attempts, even in the day, that some of the early Beguines be brought forth, but nothing ever happened. There were hagiographies that were written on some of the early Beguines with the hopes of that, but no, none of them have been acknowledged. And I hardly ever find Christians, even lifelong Christians, who've ever heard of them.
Right. Well, and you know, it really sort of is such a direct contrast to, you know, the fight we are having now with, you know, patriarchal religious authority who doesn't see women as equal, or the church, you know, the Vatican, that doesn't want to ordain women, or the nuns, you know, our beloved nuns on the bus who were, you know, had to stand up to the bishops and the Vatican for being radical feminists, for taking care of the poor. You know, it's really pretty incredible when you think about it.
Yeah.
You know, and here you have these Beguines for 800 years, you know, were religious leaders. It's absurd to think that, you know, women don't deserve their full and equal place as religious leaders.
It's mind-blowing, isn't it, that we're still having that conversation?
It is. It really is. And, you know, so I'm so glad that, you know, people like us are talking about it and educating more and more people out there. And you know what? I am so amazed. As a feminist, I feel ashamed that I didn't know about the Beguines until you suggested we chat about it. So thank you so much. I'm so glad you're bringing that to, you know, to my audience.
Wonderful. And one of the things that my favorite Beguine her name is Hedwig, H-A-D-E-W-I-J-C-H. And Hedwig, she's a really fiery writer. Her writing survived. It was found in the early 1900s in a library in Brussels, and she uses in her poetry. She's considered in Holland to be still one of the leading Dutch poets that has ever lived. So she's not unknown everywhere. But Hedwig, she used in her writing a word for God, Karen, that I really want you and your listeners to learn about. She used a word for God that is Min, M-I-N-N-E. It's a Middle English Flemish, it doesn't exist in the language any longer. But when she wrote and used this word, she used it for God. And what it meant is it means love or beloved, but it also means it has more of an activeness to it. So it means, it signifies, this is a quote from a scholar named McGinn on mysticism, it signifies the fundamental reality or power by which all things participate in God, and in which they return to God. It's sort of this interactive, it's like a relational word. So it's
sort of like
love in relationship. Sorry?
Like reciprocity in a sense?
Yes. Yes, like a dynamic experience of interrelational with the Creator, with the creative force. In what's also phenomenal in this word is that it's a feminine word. So all her pronouns in all of her poetry are she for God.
That's beautiful. Well, and you know, it's so funny. I meet with a group monthly, a Wisdom Circle group, and we had a new person show up last week, and he wanted to talk about the structure of the universe. And he was talking about how he believed that there was, you know, sort of a non-physical consciousness out there that we are a part of. And I think what he was trying to say that was God or the divine or whatever we want to call the ultimate source, you know, of all.
Mm-hmm.
But he was so sure that this source, you know, because, you know, he had astral projected and he had, you know, these out-of-body experiences and feels like he felt himself disconnected from his physical body and in the realm of that non-physical essence or energy. And he's certain that it's ambivalent, you know. And I guess I'm just feeling good hearing what you're saying, because it certainly doesn't sound like the Beguines thought the divine source was ambivalent if they were having this relationship with it, you know, if they were experiencing it the way you're describing.
Yes. She would say that they were very embodied too, Karen, which I know you'll love. They really participated in the divine nature, both in the world by engaging in acts of charity, and by contemplative practice, eyes closed, beyond the beyond of beyond egoness, ego-centered, and beyond concepts and beyond images, sort of what you were talking about. So, for them, it was not one or the other. It was really both. And this is something that's very dear to my heart. I feel this. I seek to be in relation with the divine nature in my own ministry with those in the incarcerated world, in jails and prisons. because this is where I really see and feel the presence of God in those encounters. And this is a way of participating in the divine nature that I do both in my meditation, and she does, and eyes open, engaged with the suffering. And she would say, this is my favorite words that that Hedgwick says, is that we must become men with men. We must become love or God with God, that we must become a part of this interrelating, as you said, the dynamic experience, relationship, or interpenetration, both in engaged in activities and of engaging suffering the way Christ modeled as God as human did, but also in this divine union, in a mystical sense, with eyes closed, without imagery or thought. Makes sense?
Well,
am I making sense?
Yeah. And you know, and again, I'm, you know, going back to the idea of love, and it feels like our religious institutions, as opposed to some of us who feel more comfortable with just our spirituality, you know, the religious institutions have really gotten away from love and sort of have replaced love with dogma, you know, or at least it seems, you know, it seems that way to me. You know, love has sort of taken a back seat, and you don't hear about caring about one another, you know, loving one another anymore. It's almost as if they've, you know, rewritten Jesus. You know.
Yeah. Well, we're trying to reclaim that, you know, and these women give me such a framework to be able to go, you know, to cherish the past. Like you said at the beginning, their story. Hedrick says we learn to love by loving, and so it's engaging with love. In loving acts of charity and virtue that
boy,
we
that would just sort of blow Ayn Rand's mind, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Well, Greta, let me ask you this. You know, you said that I forget the word you used, but you said something about you were using the expression in the body. And, you know, in the body as well, you know, eyes open, in other words, in the world, but also, you know, trying to reach God through that meditative state as well, you know, eyes closed, going within. Am I with you? Did I get
yes.
that? Okay.
Yes.
So, and maybe this is separate, but I'll throw it out there at you, and I wonder if you can speculate, because I mean, look, I feel like this. God made our bodies, and God would not have, created our bodies the way they are, in the sense that we can derive pleasure from our bodies. I guess I wonder why they were celibate, you know, because, I mean, we've read that sometimes it was, you know, through, you know, orgasm or ecstasy that you feel closer to God, that, you know, even, now I'm talking, you know what I'm saying? So I guess, you know, maybe that's a crazy question, and forgive me if I'm throwing you a curveball here, but because they seem to be so progressive, and I guess I just wonder, I mean, I don't know, maybe we don't know enough about them to know what they really did, but you said they absolutely had to claim to be celibate. Does celibacy rule out pleasuring yourself, you know, or is it just you can't have relations with someone else?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I would think that that's sort of settled between the individual and God on their own time. It certainly would have been an oppressive relationship to have been in a marriage, and I would say to some degree it's still difficult to have enlightened marriages, but they are obviously they're happening now. But in that time and space, They were fleeing materialism and also the demands and tyranny of marriage. I have made this choice. So, as monastics do, or the traditional Benedictines, so of celibacy. And for me, it's bringing our fullness of being to the relationship with God rather than to another human being. And I think also that it takes away any area of what kind of relationship I have with other human beings, that I'm always a safe place for both men and women. And mm-hmm. I think that is a gift.
Right.
And I think that I come out of a yoga I've background, which is and also tantrika. So
I
understand deeply what you're asking and how that energy can move one's shakti or, you know, one's personal energy into a state of ecstasy and union in that way. But I think that it's also can be done without it being so obviously the physical stimulation that is sort of required of in a more human way. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Well, I think you're talking about achieving bliss cerebrally rather than physically.
Well, I wouldn't use cerebral because that's too mental, but I would say with the channel, you know, with these women and speaking for myself, I do think that there's a state of divine union that is not stimulated through the body in that way, but it isn't from the mind either. It isn't cerebral in the sense that it's created through the mind. It is more embodied.
Okay, that confuses me, but because I'm thinking either it's through the body or through the mind. Is there something in between? You know,
well, the heart. Yeah.
Oh, well,
the
yeah,
heart.
True, true. Okay, okay,
yeah.
Okay. All right.
I think that is the meeting place, particularly for Sufis and Christians.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. Thank you. Thank you for that. So, all right. So,
and can I say one more thing,
sure,
Karen?
Yeah.
For Hedgewick, she writes that this is a union without distinction. She finds union with God is something beyond anything that any mystic had ever written. I don't know if you know Bernard de Clairvaux, but some of your listeners will, that he was using the Song of Songs as a sort of that bridegroom and lover scripture. But Hedgewick goes beyond that into a union beyond distinction that is a place where God completes God's self, that it's actually that our participation brings God to God's own liberation. So this voice is really is so unique, Hedgewick, that she sees that God, that our participating in this union, this is an intermingling that brings God into God's greater liberty.
It's so hard to language this stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wow. They sound so incredibly interesting. Were there a lot of standouts, like, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, Hedgewick? I guess what I'm asking you is, were there only one or two famous ones, or do they have a long history of good works in the world and inspirational writing and, you know,
they were quieted down. When the writing that exists Meth Shields' writing, Beatrice of Nazareth, who later became a Carmelite, Marguerite and Hedrick. The four of them have beautiful bodies of work, and they have survived. Undoubtedly, there were many more writers that have not survived, but after Marguerite was killed, they did not publish any longer. Nothing exists that's made it through. They were somewhat condemned after Marguerite's death. They were chastised. They were told that they had to go into a more organized form of living, and it became dangerous for them. They were also ridiculed. There was a period where we see in some of the that they were teased as being hypocrites, and really they were lifting their skirts for every Tom, Dick, and Harry. So it was not an easy period for the Beguines, but obviously they then did have this very, very productive period where they in the 15th and 16th century, and then they dwindled down and now into extinction. But no other writing has been found, at least, beside those four authors.
In which century was it that she was burned?
She was burned at the beginning of the 14th, 1310.
Who was it that was putting the screws to them? Was it just, the church and state were pretty much one, I guess, then.
Yeah, it was the Pope. It was actually a particular archbishop that had it in for her, and made sure that she was put into prison. And then it was the Inquisitor, who was a Dominican, sadly, because the Dominicans had been great friends of the Beguines, and they wouldn't even accept communion from a priest that they considered to be corrupt. And the Dominicans were their confessors, and the order of which they had the closest relationship. But sadly, it was a Dominican who was her inquisitor and condemned her to death.
Well, now, you said that they were pretty democratic, but did they have, like, an abbess or, something like that, like a leader? And I'm wondering, did they dress like nuns, or do we know?
Yes, they had a distinctive dress. It was very plain. They didn't have any terminology like abbess and so on. That would be more of a cloistered terminology because they were in the world. They wore, but they had some leadership, but they didn't have terminology like that. They kept it very, very cooperative. And
I'm wondering if there are any short excerpts that I didn't ask you to prepare this, so don't worry if you don't have them at your fingertips, but do you have any, short examples of any of the writing that, maybe you think is the most beautiful or meaningful?
I'll read you a very simple one that's just...
Okay, wherever you must have moved because...
It's bad again? Okay.
Yeah, it just started to break up a little bit.
Okay, I'm moving back to my spot. This is from Hedrick. I wish to devote all my time to noble consideration of great love, because she, with her great power, makes my being so wide.
So do you think she is saying, maybe this is, obvious, but she's saying goddess, not God?
Say that again?
She's referring to the divine as she. So
yes.
Did they ever refer to God as goddess rather than God?
No, they used this word min. Min.
Oh, that's true. You said they used the word min. So so they either used min or she.
It became she because min is a feminine feminine word. So So
right.
all the pronouns became she.
Wow, that is so interesting. What else should we know about them? You know, what else stands out?
Well, I think that this the beauty of I'll read something else that's from her that maybe explain would say that. With the humanity of God, you must live here on earth in the labors and sorrow of exile, while within your soul you love and rejoice with the omnipotent and eternal God in sweet abandonment. For the truth of both the humanity and the divinity is one single fruition.
Hmm.
You know, they weren't afraid of suffering, Karen. These women, they found that the suffering was important, was the location of where we meet. It's like sort of the preparation of the soul for union with God. And I feel that as someone who works with people who are suffering and have suffered so greatly, that I see that as a real, I truly feel that that is, can be for so many of us, the preparation for real meeting of God. And that when we engage love by acts of love with those who are suffering, we actually are participating in the divine nature. And this, I think, is so, we have, there's too much suffering in our world for a privatized spirituality. And this is my call and my real commitment in purpose, I feel, is to say that these women and also my own life, I feel that we must not just seek our own divine union, our experience of this bliss and connection, but we need to also engage with the suffering of the world to bring the love to the healing into those broken places. And that,
well,
that,
you know,
is the way to engage, to engage the divine.
Well, you know, that makes sense to me. But I would, I guess, though, I would ask you, because I don't know, my initial reaction to that is, couldn't you equally find the divine in joy? Why does it have to be suffering? That's, you know,
I think we do. Like the gifts of the Spirit are joy, peace, kindness, self-control, all those beautiful attributes. That is the gift of this, of the divine union, the divine participation. But and then I see that that groundedness in the divine relations, I see it spilling out into the world of engaging where there is suffering. I think
okay.
this is the wellspring. It overflows into the engagement, and I see that as particularly feminine. This is particularly what women do, is to go out to heal, to bring into wholeness the broken parts.
Right. No, I agree with you there. I guess it just, you know, it sort of reminded me, and I'm probably just way off base, you know, but when you hear the word suffering, it makes me think of, I'm trying to think of that group that we saw in the Da Vinci Code, you know, who would inflict
pain on
themselves, you know.
Because
they thought this, you know, that would, you know, their suffering somehow served them.
No. I don't mean that kind of suffering. I mean the kind of suffering that the children who've been abused and become violent, this kind of suffering that is everywhere, that there's so much so many people born into lives of suffering, not self-inflicted by any means.
Yeah, it's just their circumstance. You see, you know, children without even clean water to drink, or subjected, you know, as sex slaves and all sorts of ugliness out there.
Yes, absolutely.
So, Greta, let me just let Gus know that I see him on the switchboard. Gus, we're going to get to you in just a minute here. We're wrapping up with Sister Greta. Sister Greta, this this has really been an enlightened chat about the Beguines. I'm so glad you brought these women to us today, especially, you know, for Women's History Month. And we didn't even plan it that way, you know, but this happens so often on the show, you know, this serendipity. I guess let me ask you, if listeners wanted to learn more about the Beguines other than just Googling them, and again, they're spelled B-E-G-U-I-N-E-S, where do you recommend they go? Any books in particular, or is the internet just as good as any book? Or
there are many articles and things that one can find online, and there's more and more, I think, books. I would go to the primary source. I would love to think of people reading Hedgwick and Marguerite Poré and Mathilde de Madberg. These are beautiful texts by the original authors, and those can be bought, and they're beautiful. They take a little work. They're not easy, but that's what I would recommend. Go to the original sources of these women.
Yeah, and read in their own words. And you feel pretty confident that the translations are accurate, you know, since the language was lost?
Well, I think that they're beautiful. Maybe they'll be, done again and brought into even more beautiful the way Mirabai Starr has done with Teresa of Avila. But, you know, as they are, they do read beautifully. I certainly don't read Middle Flemish, so I'm not sure. But who knows? Maybe that'll be part of my journey.
Okay. Well, you know what, Sister Greta, thank you so much
for your... Oh, thank you, Karen. Thank you for the work that you do, and it's been an honor, and I thank you to all the listeners for their time and attention.
All right, and thank you for the work you're doing out there in the world. I appreciate you being on the show.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Well, we are about to cross the threshold into the second half of the show. You know that sound. That's what it is. And, yes, I just want to remind you that when we finish with my next guest, Gus Dzurega, I hope you'll stay tuned for my What's the Buzz segment. Tonight I'm discussing a few things. An article called Is Religion the Biggest Problem Facing Feminism, written by Sister Christine Shank, another sister joining us tonight, and it was sent in by Jeanette. And then there's also A Day in the Life of Joe Republican, sent in by Jane, and sent in from the Days for Girls website by Pat. I'm going to tell you a wonderful story about the sanitary pad revolution in India that was posted on the BBC World Service. And if there's time, Ms. Magazine had an article about Indian women reclaiming buses for International Women's Day. But it's time to chat with Gus about his new book, Fault Lines, The Culture War and the Return of the Divine Feminine. Let me tell you a little bit about Gus, just in case you don't remember him or you didn't hear our last interview together. Gus Dzurega combines a formal academic training in political science with decades of work in Wicca and shamanic healing. He has long been a third-degree elder and Gardnerian Wicca. He studied closely with Timothy White, who founded Shaman's Drum magazine. He also studied and practiced Brazilian Umbanda, I think, intensively for 6 years under Antonio Costa e Silva. He's given workshops and talks on pagan spirituality and healing in the U.S. and Canada. He holds a Ph.D. in political theory with extensive teaching and publishing experience in mainstream academia. And in this capacity, he's organized international scholarly conferences, and he's taught in Canada and Europe as well as the U.S. His book that we're, again, let me mention it, that we're talking about tonight, Fault Lines, The Culture War and the Return of the Divine Feminine, that was published by Quest. It's out this year, an in-depth study of the crisis in American society and government from a pagan perspective. But his first book was on democratic political theory and practice. His second, Pagans and Christians, The Personal Spiritual Experience, which won the Best Nonfiction of 2001 award from the Coalition of Visionary Resources. And his third book, Beyond the Burning Times, A Pagan and a Christian in Dialogue, which was co-authored with Christian Philip Johnson. And his art frequently appeared in The Shaman's Drum and the ecological journals Wild Earth and Trumpeteer. And I also want to mention, Gus is a contributor to my upcoming anthology, Voices of the Sacred Feminine, Conversations to Reshape the World. So welcome back to the show, Gus.
Thank you, Karen. It's good to be back.
Good, good. I feel the same way. I'm so glad to have you with us, and I'm so glad that you wrote this book. So let me ask you, Culture War and the Return of the Divine Feminine. I hadn't actually thought of what's going out there as a culture war, but, you know, you may very well be right. Tell me how you see it, that you picked that label.
Well, I actually didn't pick it. Pat Buchanan picked it when he gave a speech at the Republican National Convention couple of election cycles ago, when he made the point that, from his perspective, the United States was in a culture war between the forces of Christianity, as Buchanan understands that term, and I guess what he would call secular humanism, or anything that Buchanan himself did not like, something of that sort. And he used very military terminology that he compared it to the Cold War. And just as Americans were to defend the country against the communists, now they were to defend America against people who were not conservative Christians of the sort that Buchanan saw himself being. And he was warmly applauded at the convention, and from that time on, you notice that places like Fox News always use military terminology when they talk about the war on Christmas, the war on Christians, the war on, you fill it in.
Right. But they never admit to the war on women, though, do they?
No. And that is because of the basic cultural split that my book really tries to make the case for, that what is going on, well, the book argues there's three levels. The first level is a reaction to the 60s and the 70s by what is, in essence, the led by the neo-Confederate culture of the South. And what's ironic about that, and the book goes into to this in some depth, is that the real counterculture was that of the South before the Civil War, when Southern leaders expressly and very explicitly repudiated the principles of the Declaration of Independence, saying it was false, that human beings do not have equal rights, that slavery is, in fact, a superior institution to free labor, and that, therefore, it was important for the South to take enormous pride in what they called their peculiar institution. And this was a repudiation of the principles our country was founded on at the very same time, in the North in particular, events were taking place that, if we hear about them in general terms, they sound like the 60s. For example, the largest peace movement in American history, which was against the Mexican-American War. It's what Thoreau spent his night in jail over refusing to pay taxes for, that led to writing on civil disobedience that inspired men like Gandhi and Martin Luther King. It was the rise of interest in nature on its own terms as a good of its own, which you saw in the Transcendentalists and in Thoreau. It was the rise of feminism for the first time in the United States with the rise of the suffrage movement. And that's particularly important for this month, Women's History Month, that what could be called first wave or liberal feminism first really got its grounding in the United States during this time. The rise of the abolition movement, which is there, you know, what we later saw in the 60s with the civil rights movement trying to finish the job. The rise of new religions, spiritism in particular, the rise of women having active roles in these new religions, and the rise of new experimental utopian communities that were started all over the country. In other words, if we look at that period, it sounds like the 60s. And right. I argue what we're seeing then was initially on a smaller scale, that with mass college education entered onto a larger scale in the 60s and 70s, was the logical outgrowth of a free democratic society.
Well, and Gus, let me ask you this, and look, if I'm wrong, you won't embarrass me to say, oh, Karen, that's crazy. You know, you've got your history all mixed up. I'm also thinking about the founding fathers, you know, the fact that they were deists, they were Freemasons, they understood the importance of separation of church and state. Weren't they predominantly more Northerners than Southerners, or no?
No. At that time, and the Southern leaders who repudiated the Declaration of Independence admitted as much, the overwhelming majority of educated Southern elites at the time of the Revolution thought slavery was wrong. They did not know how to get rid of it, but they were hoping that they could tilt the rules of the country such that it would eventually disappear on its own. That's why they banned the slave trade, for example. And because in much of the New World, the death rate of slavery was so high that the slave trade was needed to replace those that died. American slavery was very bad, but it was not bad in that sense. And so the slave population was able to reproduce even when the slave trade was mostly, it was never entirely stopped. Most of the founders, at least the Southern ones, did not regard blacks as equal to whites. They were not in favor of integration or anything of the sort. They were hoping that somehow they could go back to Africa or somewhere. So it was certainly not advanced in our sense of the term, but it was very advanced in the sense of what came later when, with the rise of cotton, slavery became extraordinarily profitable. Many of the richest people in the United States were Southern slaveholders, and at that time, the elites decided to follow their pocketbooks rather than their morality. And so they repudiated the views of Jefferson and Madison and Washington and other Southerners that helped to lead the Revolution.
And, you know, isn't it interesting? I can't help but feel like it was kind of a, you know, a middle finger salute to the, you know, to this part of the country with the Academy Awards, with 12 Years a Slave winning the Academy Award. You know, Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I felt like when it won the award, I felt like, take that, you racists, you have to look at what you did, look at the ugliness of what you support, and, you know, it feels like to me some of them would go back to that today if they could.
Some would, I'm sure. But the issue is that the neo-Confederate culture that grew up with slavery, and around justifying slavery, transformed Southern society so that the views of a Jefferson or a Madison or a Washington would have been rejected. And it happened in religion. The Baptists were Jefferson's allies in separating church and state, for example. And the Baptists of the North, which is where they were strongest, tended to be very liberal in a lot of their social attitudes. But when they sent missionaries to the South, the missionaries began reshaping American Baptist religion to be more patriarchal, more authoritarian. And in time, the religion split. So you have Southern Baptists and Northern Baptists, who are much more liberal. The same thing happened with Methodists. So that you saw a really a basic shift that has met, and I have to say, and I was born in Virginia. There's much about the South I like beyond, except for its climate, too humid for me. But it's too many Southerners have never confronted the truth about the society that tried to break free in 1860, and have tried to make it a issue of states' rights. But if we look at how Southerners, once they're in power in Washington, have treated states' rights, they've ignored them and trod all over them. It's a case of shifting a position from power rests ultimately with the people, which was the principle of our revolution, to power rests with those who were in charge.
That's what we are seeing with all the red states and all the, all the laws that they've put in place to basically make it impossible for women to have abortions, right? And the anti-union stuff and all the rest.
Now, what's interesting to me, as I was listening to the tail end of your previous radio show, with this being Women's History Month, that Wicca and paganism actually have a fascinating role to play that perhaps your listeners would like to hear about, and that is that in the 1960s, early 60s, an English Sufi named Idris Shah, whom some people may have read or heard about, very prominent at the time as a writer on spiritual issues, decided to do a biography of Gerald Gardner, who was the man who first brought Wicca out of the broom closet, so to speak, and into the public eye, and the first public pagan tradition to be really well founded in the modern West is now called Gardnerian Wicca, named after Gerald Gardner. Anyway, Shaw decides to interview him and write a book. And at times he would go over to the home, after he had finished interviewing Gardner, he would go over to the home of a member of one of Gardner's coven, a guy named Fred Lamont, whom I know slightly, wonderful guy. And they would talk. And Shaw told Fred that he had it on, quote, the highest authority, end quote, that Gardnerian, or that Wicca was going to be a dominant spiritual current in the next century, meaning the 21st century. He then told Fred, frankly, I don't see it. And he never really published the biography under his own name. It did get published under another name, but Jack Bracelin. But Fred told me that by highest authority he meant spiritual planes, that he had it from spiritual authorities in other dimensions. Well, what are the dominant themes of Wicca? There are two. One is the sacredness of the earth. The other is the sacred feminine. And if we look at what's happened in mainstream non-conservative religions since then, a great many women have theologians in Christianity, in Judaism, in Buddhism, have begun to urge, starting in the 80s, really, as they became old enough to have their doctorates of divinity and what have you, pushing for mainstream religions to focus on the feminine side of God. As I was reading these women, researching my book, I was struck over and over and over again that they were inspired to do this by attending workshops led by Starhawk, a Wiccan leader.
Interesting.
Not Wiccanarian. She comes from a different tradition, but definitely a tradition that maintains both of these themes as major, in fact, almost defining characteristics of her reclaiming tradition, the sacredness of the earth, and the importance of the divine feminine. Looking back, it seems that Shah perhaps should have trusted his spiritual authorities a little more, because outside of the catastrophe that is conservative Christianity and its equivalents in other traditions, we do see, in fact, I would argue it's in ecology and nature as well, but certainly the rise of the divine feminine as a important spiritual tradition or a current transforming religions across the world. And to that end, I was struck with the Dalai Lama, who, and I quote him in the book, as describing himself as a feminist, and the tradition that the Dalai Lama comes from is one of the most patriarchal traditions in the world. Tibetan Buddhism, traditionally the most senior nun has to prostrate herself if she meets him with the most junior monk, because if she lives an exemplary life, she will eventually be reincarnated as a man and so have a chance at enlightenment. That was the sort of standard line. And most recently, the Dalai Lama said that he thought possibly the next Dalai Lama would be a woman.
Wow.
That is extraordinary.
Right.
A rapid shift. But it's not just in Christianity. It's across the board that we see this happen.
So do you think there's much hope that Pope Francis, considering, you know, he's the new, you know, everybody loves him, do you think there's any chance he will come round to saying women can be ordained, or you think that not in this lifetime?
I have no idea. I do not understand Catholic politics well enough to such a, my opinion would be any more important than that of anybody else. It would be what if it's. It struck me that he's quite the unusual pope compared to many his predecessors, several of his predecessors.
Right.
So if the pope does it, it would possibly be him. But that's an that is a major shift, and
yeah.
It would completely cause a reorganization of the entire Catholic hierarchy. It would be wonderful if it happened, but imagine the Catholic, you know, they have priests. Can you imagine the Catholics talking about priestesses? It's hard for me to imagine.
Well, you know, he could always say he had a vision. And, you know, who can question that, right?
Now, that works for more. I don't know if it would work for Catholics.
Who does it work for? I'm sorry.
The Mormons, who
the Mormons
at this point discovered blacks could could be equal members of the church after a long time where they explicitly denied it.
Oh, so that's how they justified it? It was a vision?
Yep.
Well, and wasn't that how the leader of the Mormons also got the tablets and everything? I mean, that was sort of a visitation or something too, wasn't it? Or am I remembering wrong?
My understanding from talking to Mormons is that it wasn't a vision. He was given them, and they were quite three-dimensional. I have no idea.
Okay.
I don't have a dog in that fight again.
Okay. Well, going back to the idea that, you know, the sacred feminine is on the rise, there were some statistics from University of New York that, you know, a few years ago that supported that idea. If you combined all the hybrids of, I'll just loosely say, paganism that revere a goddess or sacred feminine, it showed that along with evangelicals that, you know, paganism was on the rise. I mean, I don't know if there's been a new study in the last 5 years or so. This is probably, you know, further back than that, but I would think by now those numbers had, you know, would have only increased.
The it's a little harder to tell in the U.S. than in Canada, because the Canadian census asks people's religions, and for constitutional reasons, the American census does not. That being so, what the Canadian census shows is a continual significant rate of increase in the pagan spiritual traditions. Every year there's more. And certainly if you look at the size of pagan festivals, at the number of books published, that would certainly support that too. The impression I get is that we're growing at a very, if anything, we're growing too fast, in the sense that the number of people who want to learn exceeds the number of people able to teach, which is why increasingly many people learn from books and from the Internet.
Right, right. And there is just, there's a vast disparity among the learning going on out there too. You know, it's not like there's sort of a solid foundation. And, you know, and I also have, you know, I also wonder about the people who want to be pagans just to learn to do magic or something like that. You know, they're not really in it for the spiritual aspects. You know, they're in it because, you know, maybe they want to see if they can, you know, shape their reality or something.
Well, I think probably every religion, once it gets past a very small number, attracts people who come in for all sorts of different, not particularly religious reasons. In my case, it happened because I encountered the Wiccan goddess. So from the very beginning, my interest was 100% religious. In fact, all my interest in learning how to do magic evaporated when I met her. But I would say that speaking as a Gardnerian and as a Wiccan, a great many Wiccan traditions, and this is something non-pagans probably find hard to believe, in our rituals we invite the gods to come, and often they do. And so I remember after my first experiences with the goddess, being perplexed by the interest of Christian theologians to prove that God existed. It was like, why do you want to do that? To me, it's as clear that our deity exists as that the person I'm talking to exists.
Right, right.
It's sort of a waste of time to do that. But it's a standard thing in dominant Christian traditions. So I think that even if somebody gets involved initially because they want magical powers, the longer they're involved and the more they have encounters with Wiccan deities, the less that's going to matter. If anything, I found the Wiccan community to be extraordinarily cautious about using magic in any way that could be manipulative of other people. It's one of our one of basic principles. You don't do that. I've seen very little evidence of people wanting to do that. I'm sure there are those that do, but not.
Yeah, and I wasn't saying, you know, they get into it to use it, you know, use the magic badly, but it just to maybe feel like they have more power in their life, you know, more control over their life, you know, kind of a thing. But Gus, I know this is maybe kind of a curveball, and feel free to decline, but I wondered if you wanted to share your experience of discovering the Wiccan goddess.
Oh, no, I have no problem. I had received my PhD in political theory at Berkeley, and shortly after that, because I sold my artwork to pay for my research. I joked I was the starving academic who did art for a living. you meet people doing that are not part of the normal academic community. One claimed to be a magician. And after I got the PhD, I thought I wasn't going to be doing this much longer. I was going to be living a normal academic life. I don't have to be completely respectful of my customers, so I dared him to show me magic because I wanted to see how he would get out of it. Well, to make a long story short, he showed me. I asked if I could start learning, if he would teach me. He said yes. And about 6 months later, he said, would you like to go to a Wiccan Sabbath? Because I had made it very clear to him I was completely uninterested in anything spiritual. When you sell your goods on Telegraph Avenue, you see so many people trying to do something for your soul that you get pretty much immunized against it. So I was not interested. But to be invited to a witch's Sabbath, wow, okay, sure. And I got there, and your pagan listeners, there's something called pagan standard time, which means things happen when they happen, not necessarily according to the time that they were announced they would happen. And I was compulsively on time at the time.
Mm-hmm.
An hour passes, nothing's happening. A second hour is passed, nothing is happening. And I'm, at this point, wishing I hadn't come and trying to figure out how to leave without embarrassing my friend who had invited me. And then finally they formed a circle in a park up in the Berkeley Hills. And the priest and priestess walk out, and he invokes the goddess. And suddenly, as quick as flicking a light switch, I'm surrounded by a presence that is feminine, but with a sense of nature, of streams and meadows and forests, even though I saw nothing with my eye or my eyes, it was the most beautiful experience I had ever had in my life up until then. She was also the most loving presence I had ever encountered, so much so that I realized I had never really understood what love was before this, and far and away the most powerful presence I had ever encountered, although the power was in the power of love. It was sort of like with love like this, who needs power?
Right.
And she was, I guess, there for about 30 seconds in my experience. I was a political scientist. I studied power. I was fascinated by power. Those 30 seconds eliminated all personal interest in power that had never come back. My interest in magic shifted to only its role in healing, which I've practiced for over 20 years since then. And my thought was, oh, my God, here's a religion where they ask their God to come, and she does. And at that point, I became a pagan and have never looked back.
Wow. Well, that was pretty profound. And I do want to get back to your book, but I want to ask you quickly. I'm just really curious, what was the magic he showed you, if you don't mind my asking?
Well, the thing is, it would take a while to tell the story, but one of the sort of cherry on top of the cake, so to speak, that completely shattered my sense of how the world worked, is we went to a place where rituals had been done, and it was on the UC campus in Berkeley, and we were looking for a particular kind of spook that did not show up. And then I saw, quite a distance from us, something about 3 feet tall, transparent, white, but very pale. And he said, do you see anything? And I said, well, I thought, don't give him any details. Be honest, but tell him nothing more than the minimum. And I said, yes. He said, is it over there between those two bushes? I said, yes. Is it 3 feet tall? Yes. Is it white? I said, yes, but I can barely see it. He said, well, let me see what I can do about that. He was carrying a staff. He put the staff down on the ground, or leaned against it, I should say. All of a sudden, it got totally easy to see. And yet he was 40, 50 feet from it. And I thought, oh, my God, this guy's for real. And, he's since become one of my best friends. I studied with him, as I say, for about a year. And the 6 months before that, and then for some time after that, as I got more involved with Wicca.
What was it he actually did? I'm sorry, I must have missed something.
He leaned against his staff with his eyes closed and sent it some kind of communication. I heard nothing, but it immediately got brighter. And then after a while, when it was time for us to leave, he went back, leaned against his staff, closed his eyes, and it disappeared completely. And we left. We walked right by where it had been, and I got down on my hands and knees and looked around. It was gravel, two juniper bushes, and a brick wall.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
I can see.
You were
sold. Thank you for sharing those two stories. I appreciate that. It's always good to, hear about the real deal, But let's go ahead and get back to your book. You talked about the first section. Did you want to elaborate a little bit on the other two?
Well, yeah, I will. Because in a sense, it's called fault lines because the image I'm using is that any society has tensions within it. Ours has three very deep ones, and they're all coming alive and shaking at the same time. The first one is this cultural split between the North and South, the Democratic North and the Neo-Confederate South that is reaching a crisis point we haven't seen since before the Civil War. The second goes to the roots of what the West is as a culture, which is that we're based on, inspired by the Enlightenment and the teachings of science, the teachings of democratic ethics and distrust of authoritarian hierarchies, and also the rise of the market economy. But those three institutions of the modern world that really set it far outside of anything beforehand all have the roots in the Enlightenment. And the ethic that generated them ultimately had Christian foundations. So if you read, say, John Locke, who gave the teachings that later appeared in our Declaration of Independence, the whole notion of human rights had a religious foundation based on Locke's very liberal, not conservative, but very liberal interpretation of Christianity. Okay. The problem is that science in particular undermined and ultimately, in the eyes of many, eliminated the spiritual authority on which it and the other institutions of the modern world were rooted. And you had a crisis of what I call nihilism, or the lack of belief in any ultimate values, that first shook up Europe. There's some interesting historical reasons why it hit Europe first. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and then is now hitting us. And so you see a culture that no longer pays much attention to any kind of founding ethics. Our banks are run by criminals. Our corporations are run by people who are no better. They get away with anything, slap on the hand if they're caught. We see recently the CIA was found to be spying on Congress, which is a complete violation of every principle this country was founded on. We'll see whether even that leads to any serious consequences for the criminals that did that. We have essentially a system of rule by the worst in our society, not the best or even the average. And most Americans know it. So that you have this kind of political crisis because those in charge no longer believe in the principles required to keep a free society going. Then there's a third, and those two fault lines, if you will, the 60s one and this one, are very negative in their implications for the future of the U.S. and of free societies. But there's a third, very interesting one, and that's the one that Wicca and neo-paganism is playing a role in. And that is that all of our ways of thinking about the world, the Enlightenment itself, have the roots in agricultural societies. And agricultural societies, for a variety of reasons the book goes into, tend to look upon nature as needing to be controlled, as at masculine and warrior values as superior to all others, at societies in terms of hierarchies. And this is true whether the religion is Christian or pagan or something else. But the world that the Enlightenment gave us is one based on very different ethics, and it's one that has undermined those old societies. The South really sees itself as a representative of that agricultural heritage, hence the hatred of, or dislike and distrust of cities, of science, of principles of equality between men and women or between people of different races. This kind of world has in some ways a lot in common with the hunting-gathering cultures before the rise of agriculture. And that is why if we look at the religions that are attempting to adapt themselves to the needs of modern men and women, we find a focus on nature as good in itself and also on the feminine as modifying and perhaps even at times overruling the more masculine hierarchical ways of thinking that have characterized religion up till now. And so paganism, ironically, if the book's argument is right, paganism and those modern neo-paganism, I should say, and those religions that are picking up on its two main currents are bringing the ethical and spiritual foundations of human life into greater harmony with the modern world as the old hierarchical, monotheistic, transcendental approaches to spirituality have become less and less and less relevant to the lives of modern men and women. And we see it not just in Christianity, but Buddhism, Judaism, and religion. There's even now a significant among modernizing Muslims feminist movement in Islam.
Wow. Well, and I just heard recently that there are some female imams in China, which I haven't Googled it yet, but there's supposed to be some sort of controversy over there about it. But just the fact that they exist kind of blew me away.
Yeah. Well, I have a former student of mine, a Muslim woman, part Egyptian, part Moroccan, in terms, I think, of her family heritage, lives in this country. I won't give any details because I have not okayed this with her, but she's active in feminist politics, does not wear a scarf, is married to a Muslim man, has kept her maiden name, and in other words, demonstrating in her own life quite clearly, and she's been active in important issues in Washington, that, she and other Muslims can be as good and tolerant and accepting a citizen as anybody else in this country. And
yeah.
She's not alone.
So, Gus, to go back to what you said a moment ago, because I want to make sure I understood it, you said you think it was the agricultural society that started to bring in these patriarchal ideas, the monotheism, the other different qualities. So we would be talking about the values pre-agricultural societies, or the ones that could save us, so to speak. Did I get that right?
Sort of. I basically argue in the book that there have been three fundamental shifts in the nature of social life in the world. The first, and far the longest, were human societies as hunter-gatherers. And from what we know of surviving societies of hunter-gatherers, or those who were in very, very, relatively speaking, early stages of agriculture, because these shifts hardly turn on a dime, they were much more egalitarian than what came later. There were distinct roles between men and women, but they were much more equal in their social status. That is, women did some things, men did other things, but women's things were not looked down upon by men in any sense that mattered. And nature was the ideal relationship between human beings and the earth was one of harmony.
Mm-hmm.
As agriculture got established, you got greater inequalities. You had the rise of cities. The cities were often very hierarchical. At the same time, you had the rise of the capacity and sometimes the need to use the military to, if you had a bad harvest or something like that, to take it from somebody else. They needed the military in return. You started getting a fatal logic at that level. If you look at the writings of early city-states, often our relation to the gods was sort of analogous to the slaves' relation to us. We existed to serve them. This was not something you saw in hunter-gatherer societies. You started seeing animal sacrifice. This was very minor, if it existed at all, in hunter-gatherer societies. You saw human sacrifice. You saw the gods becoming much more hierarchical, and the political systems did too, and they reinforced one another. The first monotheistic attempt that I know of was in Egypt, imposed by a pharaoh. I think it's not accidental that a man claiming absolute power tried to impose a deity of absolute power and failed. But shortly thereafter, Moses succeeded in his own society, and it was done rather masterly. This period however, was many historians call this period the Axial Age. And what's interesting to me about the Axial Age, it's when the earliest forms of our major contemporary religions arose, is they shifted from a focus on harmony with the world to salvation from it or enlightenment from it. Life was bad. Society was not going to get improved. And so it was important to get right with God, to achieve enlightenment, that your fate depended to a large extent on how successful you could be at freeing yourself from the suffering of the world. And it took many different forms.
So it was, they were separating themselves. It was a separation from nature.
Yeah, the world, so the eminence of spirit was downgraded or even denied in some cases, and the transcendence of spirit was emphasized. Christianity clearly fits.
Yeah, it's and all about your reward after you die rather than, you know, the life you're living on earth.
Exactly. And so, and the world is a veil of tears. Well, it was a veil of tears, and sensitive people saw that and therefore looked to life after that or to becoming more separate from that. I'm not putting down on this. It was a response, I argue, to the kind of society people saw around them. You know, think of the Buddha's story of he saw all this suffering, and that was when he gave up any thought of being the prince that his father wanted him to be and went out on a spiritual quest that ultimately led to his enlightenment and to Buddhism. So the world sucked for most people, and sensitive people were bothered deeply by that. But if you look today, in the developed world, the poor are a minority group. Most of the Buddhists I know, their major focus is not getting off the wheel of rebirth. I mean, they may want to do that in some sense, but that's not the chief appeal. The chief appeal is greater equanimity, the greater peacefulness, the greater equilibrium that Buddhist practices can bring about for people. And if you look at Christianity, most American Christians don't believe in hell, according to the polls I've read. You're seeing a decisive shift in how spirituality speaks to people. And it's a speaking that I would argue is more returning to the notion of harmony, but in a very different society. And that notion of harmony means harmonizing male and female, and it means harmonizing humans with the earth. And that plugs us right back into what Idris Shah's spiritual forces told him so many years ago. That fits the needs of modern men and women. Whereas,
well, this does not bode well for the patriarchy. Yay.
It's very ill for it. However, there's no guarantees as to who is going to win in the short run. I'm not saying, oh, relax, we're going to win. We might win in 500 years. We might win in 300 years. There's a lot of uncertainty along the way. Shifts this fundamental in a society really deeply shake it up. And we're seeing, particularly in the neo-Confederate attempt to return to the virtues of real and supposed of agricultural hierarchical societies, a willingness to destroy this one if necessary, and that is profoundly disturbing.
Well, they think they're going to see Jesus, you know. Those end timers. I mean, is that what you're referring to in a sense?
Well, that's a part of it, but I'm thinking more of, it's more a sense of they know that the world they live in is deeply hostile to their values, and so if they can, they will destroy that world.
Right.
Whether to speed up the Armageddon or whatever, I'm not going to try to second guess them. They themselves disagree amongst themselves.
Right.
They agree
right.
on what they want. And
it's sort of like the guy who says, "Well, if I can't have her, nobody will." the jealous husband or the jealous boyfriend. You know, he'd rather see her dead than with another man.
Now, what's positive here is that I've had Pentecostal friends who are in Missouri, which is a center for Pentecostal Christianity, who said the younger generation is quite different. They are shifting on social issues. And if they shift on those social issues, the one, had somebody looked at European Christianity at the time of the religious wars and said, here's the potential for a free society, people would have wondered what mental disease they had, what drugs were getting in the way of their rationality. This was a time of incredible slaughter. A third of the population of Germany was slaughtered or died. And the Czech Republic, the same, and pretty bad elsewhere. And yet that's what happened. So I don't think we should underestimate the capacity of religious people to change. And I think what we're seeing, possibly in some of the younger Pentecostals and evangelicals, is the leading edge of that change, of rethinking their traditions to be more in line with the needs of the modern world. And so there's,
reason
for
hope.
The jury is out. We're living in a very interesting time. And I think that the one thing that pagans and others with that kind of approach that I'm describing can do is have confidence that if the United States is going to make it through this transition, because it may not. There's also ecological disasters that, if they're truly horrible, could destroy technological society and bring us back to agricultural civilization. But that if the United States is to make it through this in a positive way, we are the leading edge. We are the ones who, more clearly than other traditions perhaps, can see what needs to be done, and in so doing, inspire other traditions. As Starhawk, I think this is remarkable, is that the women who carried her message into their own traditions didn't decide to become reclaiming witches. They said, no, our traditions can benefit from these themes too.
Right, right.
As they do, you get greater harmony within the different religious traditions of this country. And
yeah.
That, to me, is a wonderful possibility.
Tempering those patriarchal, that authoritarian father. Well, Gus, we are really running out of time here. Can you wrap this up in 2 minutes?
Buy my book and read it.
tell us your website and whatever you would say to wrap.
Well, the website is Dizerega, Dizerega, my last name, .com. It is about 60% of where I would like it to be. I don't like web design much, so it's moving slowly, but you can order the book there. You go to the main page, and then up at the top there'll be books. I also write quite often for a pagan site called Witches and Pagans, and an interfaith site called Patheos, and I usually mention what I'm writing there on my blog on my website. So you can find links to those sites there. Quest Publishers, of course, is the publisher, and you can order the book there. It would be wonderful if you go to a local bookstore and support the local bookstore by ordering it there. It's not an expensive book. And the argument, I think anyone who's listened this far can tell, is a complicated one, because you're looking at three major historical and philosophical shifts. So I can only touch on a few high points. So I really, you know, hope that anybody who's intrigued by this or wants to understand what our country is going through right now will be tempted to look. And even somebody who is not particularly spiritual will find that about 85-90% of the book, you don't have to be particularly spiritual to read and understand and be able to evaluate and perhaps even agree with.
Right.
It's just that the spiritual is the largest context in which we find sense in the world, and it's certainly the context in which I do.
Well, Gus, I love your insights. I saw you on Patheos, and that's how I became familiar with your work. And you make a lot of sense. And I hope the conclusions you've drawn, they make absolute sense to me too. And I just hope you're right.
I hope I'm right too. otherwise, we're in the middle of, and it will continue to get a pretty dark time, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Well, patriarchy isn't going to roll over and play dead. I mean, I could literally see a scenario where the South tries to secede from the Union or something. You know, I mean, that might sound crazy because they can't afford to, but it's crazy out there.
And go and to work out their own fate.
You said it could get darker before it gets better, and I'm looking at what the 2010 election brought us with all of these red state controlled governments and governors, and what it's meant for women, it is not good. What it's meant for workers is not good. And all the Koch brother money and all of the conservative money buying the airtime to distort the voter, who's already a low information voter. I really worry that in the gerrymandered districts, it really scares me that the Republicans could control the House, the Senate, and steal the presidency. And where would that leave us? That Ted Cruz for president? I'm trying to think, the libertarian guy for president? That's scary.
It's scary. My worry is that if they do it, the only way they'll manage to do it at this point and some of them are talking about this, completely gaining the Electoral College. And if they do that, they may win the president, but they will destroy the American system, because the only way, especially when the differences within the country are as deeply rooted as they are, the only way a government can be seen as legitimate is if the election is seen as reasonably fair on both sides. We've seen that the Republicans don't regard it as legitimate even when it is reasonably fair if they lose. But if in the process of gaming the system, they make it also clearly and obviously unfair to everybody else in the country by gaming the Electoral College, that creates a constitutional crisis of the first order. It would be basically a coup d'etat by the right wing, and I would say at that point, the best thing that the states that don't like it can do is to secede themselves and say, we're out of here. Because otherwise, you've got two groups, one of which explicitly sees itself as at war with the other, holding political power and trying to impose its rule in a way such that they can never lose. That's not a positive scenario. So hopefully the next election they will fail in their effort to gain the Electoral College, and that kind of outcome will not happen. Because in the long run, there are two other problems, ecological and the problem of the 1%, but in the long run, the neo-Confederates are losing because they're losing the next generation.
Yeah. So we just have to wait them out.
Yeah. If we can wait them out, then, you know, the possibilities are much more positive, but we still have to deal with issues like global warming. We still have to deal with issues like the fact that the banks, largest corporations, and Congress are all, to the most part, part of a single oligarchy whose interests are quite different from those of the American people.
Well, I don't know about you, but I keep waiting for Americans to take to the streets. You know, are you not amazed that they have not been disgruntled enough to be, you know, in the streets and in protest about all of this?
Not really, for two reasons. One is that, and I think this is the most important, most people have no idea what to put in its place. And Quest asked me for my second book for them, and I began working on it, to do it not on the sort of spiritual and cultural dimension, which is what this book is about, but on political theory and, okay, how can we make sense in terms of institutions and what to do? And I'm hardly the only person doing this, but what we need is for more Americans to know that there are alternatives out there. Like, for example, in economics, the Mondragon worker cooperatives of northern Spain have turned that area into Spain's richest, most prosperous, lowest unemployment, and yet the co-ops work with a rule that the CEO can never make more than six times what the lowest paid worker in that particular business makes.
Yeah.
And they compete successfully with more traditional corporations. There are options out there. A lot of my work is on helping people know about these options. The next book will certainly be doing that. So that's part of it. People don't go on the streets unless they're desperate, unless they know of an option. The second is that it's not that desperate yet for most people.
Yeah.
Most people are still too comfortable. The middle class is shrinking. I think their comfort is short term, but it's still great enough that most don't want to do it.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I've thought that myself. Well, Gus, thank you. It's been very interesting. I wish you all the best with the book, and I'm looking forward to reading it myself. You make a lot of sense to me, and I want to learn more of the details. So thank you so much for being on the show, and I'm sure we'll be in touch. And, you know, the best to you.
And to you. Thank you so much.
Okay, good night. Thank you.
Good night.
Well, if you're still there with me, listeners, and this is being recorded and you can still hear it when you catch it from the archives, I apologize for not getting to those articles I mentioned earlier in the show, but the conversation with Gus was just too good to interrupt and cut off. I can always get to these articles next show. So thank you so very much, and have a wonderful week. And I just thank you for tuning in every week. I thank you for your listener loyalty. And I will be back with you next week with Heather Mendel and Kathy Pagano. So until next week, dear listeners, may Goddess embrace you in her golden wings. Good night.